Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Cheryl. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for having me today on your show.
Oh, thank you so much for being on the show today, Cheryl. And I want to invite those people who are out there in Radio Land. I want to welcome everybody to the debut of Social Work Today with Shirley Tabb, emanating from the nation's capital, where we have record amounts of snow here from the blizzard we had that started Friday and went into about midday. Yesterday, I believe it was. May have been midday this morning, but we got a lot of snow, so everybody's kind of hunkered down, and hopefully people are listening to Social Work Today. But audience, let me just tell you a little bit about Cheryl. Cheryl, you pronounce your last name how?
Derricott.
Derricott. Cheryl Patrice Derricott is my guest on my debut show, and she is the founder and editor-in-chief for 30 Minute Manager, an indie press she created in 2011. She's a life strategist and has for the 21st century. She's a frequent contributor to numerous publications and engaging speaker, a trusted confidant, and highly respected consultant. Cheryl is also the author of the book that we are going to talk about in depth today, and that is Being the Grown Up, Taking Care of Someone with a Terminal Illness. The book is available in paper and ebook formats. Her bio can be tweeted in four words: artist, activist, writer, vegan. And for more information, you can go to www.30MinuteManager.com. She has a wonderful website, too. And I have gone, Cheryl, to your website and also to your Twitter account and read some very motivational pieces there. One day I was really going through some stuff, and you had one on there about fear. And I read it over and over and over again, and I got so busy that day I wanted to send you an email and just thank you for that, because it really did help me that day with what I was going through. And
so
this
great
show also, our audience, is being dedicated to the memory of Cheryl's mother, who passed away from pancreatic cancer in 2010. And this is so important to me because I was involved in Cheryl's life at that time, because I was the Medicaid case manager, independent contractor, who did the Medicaid application for her mother to get in-home help and assistance. And her mother was a very elegant woman. And I remember how strong she appeared during this most difficult time in her life. And Cheryl was just so staunch as an advocate and caregiver for her mother. And she told me at that time that she was going to write a book about her encounter, this whole process of providing care, particularly for someone you love who has a terminal illness. So that's what brought us to this show today. So Cheryl, you can take it and talk a little bit about what you went through as you were caring for your mother, how you went on, and you can tell us a little bit about what an indie press is. I was talking to one of my friends who is also a social worker, and we were figuring that indie press must have meant that you published your own books.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that generous and kind introduction, Shirley. And I so appreciated the opportunity to meet with you and have professional counsel during my mother's illness, because it was a very challenging time. And I know
we'll
dive in a little more about the importance of having professional help when families and others are faced with being caregivers.
Yes.
You are absolutely correct. And Indie Press is an independent press. I self-published my book through my press. My press is actually set up as an LLC, so I can over the years published more books, whether
Great.
I write them myself or I publish with other authors. And so, yeah, that's why I set it up more so as a business instead of just a one-off for this particular book.
Right.
And this book actually came about because a number of my friends at the time were asking me if I was keeping a journal.
Yes.
Many of my friends and I were just beginning to think about care for our parents who were baby boomers.
Yes.
And because of my mother's unfortunate cancer diagnosis,
yeah.
it really put me in the hot seat first.
Yeah.
And so suddenly, you know, in my conversations with them, I was filled with, you know, how to manage doctor's visits and thinking about things like social workers and power of attorney and making sure wills were up to date. And they were just like, wow, we haven't thought about any of this with our parents yet. And what would happen, God forbid, if they were diagnosed with a terrible illness like your mom? So,
right.
you know, at the time, I shared with them, truthfully, all the notes that I'm taking have to do with her care. But, you know, about a year or so after my mom died, I thought, well, maybe I can organize this into a tool that would be helpful for others.
Yes. Well, I must say it is certainly more than helpful. I have, when I went to your website and you were generous enough to allow people to download part of it and read about it, and I read it and I just found myself wanting more, while I have certainly been in that position as well. Of course, when my father died in 2004, I'm from Arkansas, so my dad died in 2004, and I ended up bringing my mother from Arkansas here to the District of Columbia, and my background was in child welfare, and I knew absolutely nothing about elder care. So when people
Right.
find themselves in the position that we found ourselves, and as other people are finding themselves, you have to get busy and really, really become astute at doing this. Otherwise, it will be even more stressful. And I remember in reading your book, you were talking about going to the doctor and how you must make this a purposeful trip, not just going in there, sitting down thinking you're going to chit-chat with the doctor, because doctors don't have that kind of time. So you need to, and I had to learn that I would have my questions written down. I would know what my goal was, what I wanted to have accomplished once we left there. And my mother at that time was not sick. She was old and had some diabetes and arthritis and stuff, but about a year, well, not quite a year after she was here, she had a brain hemorrhage, and she lasted maybe a couple of months. And during that time, I had to really ramp it up, and because I was taking care of her, and she was, for all intents and purposes, she was all total care. And so that was a whole different effort that I had to learn in terms of managing home health aides and talking with home health agencies and making sure that she was getting state-of-the-art care and all of this. So I can only imagine what you went through when your mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. You had to go into overdrive.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a good place. I'll just read a little bit from the introduction to help give your listeners, you know, really a feel for how this all unfolded rather quickly.
Yeah.
So from the introduction of the book, I'll just start a little bit here into the first page or so.
Good.
When you're called upon to make choices about life and death, you want to know that you're making the best possible decisions you can for that person. I learned firsthand that caregiving is not for the faint of heart. In April 2010, my mom went to see her primary care doctor to get the results of some blood tests he had performed earlier in the week. She had been feeling sick, and by the time she returned to her doctor's office, her skin and eyes had a yellowish tint.
Mm.
Her doctor recognized the symptoms of jaundice and mm-hmm. sent her to the hospital. My mom called me at work to tell me she was being admitted. By the time I got to the hospital, I found out my mom's first round of x-rays revealed that her pancreas looked quote-unquote suspect, and the doctor had concerns about her lungs. Next up, a round of computerized tomography, CT scans. After he reviewed the CT scans, the doctor recommended my mom see a gastroenterologist who would do a test that puts a tube with a tiny camera down her throat to take a look at the lower organs. The test was scheduled for a few days later. My mom grew increasingly nervous with each additional test. So did I. That Tuesday, the gastroenterologist told me that on a good day, the test would only take 20 to 30 minutes. 2 hours and 15 minutes later, the doctor finally came into the waiting room. He looked at me with great sympathy in his eyes, his demeanor indicating he did not want to tell me the news. He sat down next to me and told me today had not gone as he had hoped. My mom had a tumor in her pancreas. It was large and invasive and was attached to her liver and intestines, too. It was inoperable. He went on to say it was rare that this type of tumor was benign, and my mom probably had pancreatic cancer. This was the first time a doctor had used the C word during my mom's first week in the hospital. And as if this were not enough to comprehend, the doctor said he also saw spots on one of my mom's lungs, suggesting the cancer had already spread. Medical professionals would say the cancer had metastasized.
Right.
The gastroenterologist had already called the hospital oncologist, cancer doctor, for a consultation. At age 45, my new life as a caregiver and patient advocate began, while at the same time, at age 64, my mom's life began to end.
Yes.
I spent the next few months taking care of my mom until her death in August 2010. Pancreatic cancer is often swift and brutal. My mom's 4 months of life from the time of her diagnosis is normal for many who get this disease. 1 year survival is common, and 5 year survival is rare. Friends encouraged me to write about my experience, a contemporary memoir which would include the nuts and bolts of managing terminal illness, dying, and death. We were reaching the age where care for our parents is a looming reality. Yes. My mom's terminal cancer just put me in the hot seat first.
Wow. I mean, that is a daunting reality, as you said, that those of us, well, I'm a baby boomer, and certainly our parents, of course, my parents, a lot of people who are my age, our parents have gone on because they were much older than your mother. But and I was reading in chapter 14, talk a little bit about self-care and who takes care of the caregiver. I remember when I was taking care of my mother, and I don't recall if it was a social worker or if it was a physician who told me that, I forget what the statistical number was, but there was a statistic that said in many, many instances, the caregiver dies long before the care receiver, because as caregivers, we tend to just be so just so into taking care of that loved one and wanting to provide the best care till we neglect ourselves. Particularly, I remember with me and my mother, because I am a diabetic, and by the time my mother, rest her soul, was dead and buried, my blood sugar levels were in the 400s, and
wow.
my doctor, yes, my doctor said to me one day, I went in, she said, Miss Tab, I don't know how you are still walking around. And I guess I was just operating on just pure adrenaline because I wanted the best for my mother, and she wanted for nothing. Every time she told my sister that every time she grunted, I was taking her to a different doctor. And I just wanted to provide the ultimate care for her, but I wasn't thinking about myself. So tell us a little bit about how caregivers can take good care of themselves so they are able to continue providing care to people they love.
Yeah, this is critically important, particularly if people are going to be caregivers for long periods of time. I mean, you really hit the nail on the head. And a lot of these items are going to seem obvious, but when you're in the middle of caregiving, it's very counterintuitive to mm-hmm. take care of yourself because you're so focused on the other person.
Right.
It begins with a proper diet. I think it's very important for the caregiver to remember to eat. And make sure that they're taking care of their own diet while they're also providing good, nutritious meals to the person they're taking care of. A level of exercise, even if that's just having a family member or a friend or while a professional is in your home, go out, take a walk, get around the block a few times. I occasionally went to a yoga class. Mm. Mm-hmm. Anything to make sure you're continuing to get some movement when you're taking care of someone else.
Yeah.
Also, the person may actually enjoy having some visits with other people. You know,
of course.
When you're the primary caregiver, it's a very one-on-one relationship.
Exactly.
But that person often enjoys having the company of family or friends in brief spurts as their illness will allow. So that's a great time for you to take a little walk, run some errands, go to the grocery store, pick up the prescription. I also think it's really important for people to seek out counseling if they need it. And this is also sometimes challenging in communities of color that don't have a history of accessing mental health professionals.
Right.
But this is a big one. Sometimes people will have a hard time coming to grips with a terminal diagnosis of a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
There are many levels to grief, including what's called anticipatory grief.
Right.
When you find out actually that someone has a terminal illness and there's not a lot that the medical profession can do. So there are a variety of ways to seek out counseling through hospital or through hospice, recommendations of family and friends, recommendations at church or sometimes now workplaces have gotten much better about, you know, preventative care, offering employees access to counseling services because they understand that we all have multiple roles to play in addition to our job.
Exactly. And I found when my mother, when I was caring for my mom, and I found this out the hard way because I was thinking, as you said, it's counterintuitive. You should know these things, but you just don't think about it. And I was thinking, well, I don't need to worry about family medical leave. My boss and I are cool. We have lunch together, and she'll understand if I am out taking care of my mama. That was not the case. And what I had to understand is that managers have a job, and they play a role, and they are supposed to get the work done because they have managers over them who are expecting them to meet the bottom line. Then, of course, as caregivers, we have a role because that person, our mom or whoever it is totally dependent on us for their care, and thank God for the Family Medical Leave Act. And
that's
it
right.
just happened that by the time, I think my mother had her brain hemorrhage on, let's say, a Sunday or a Monday, and my family medical leave was just approved on that Friday. And I was told that when I called in to and left a message for my boss that I was at the hospital because something had happened to my mother, and she didn't understand and was not very sympathetic of with that. But I was just so glad that I had family medical leave, and I do believe that everything happens to us. As somebody said, it doesn't happen to us, it happens for us. And so what I did as a result of that experience, as I was working as an independent contractor helping people to get home health care for their parents and other loved ones, husbands and different ones, the first thing I told them was, go get your family medical leave in check, and I explained to them why. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Cheryl, but I just had to get that in before I lost my thought.
Oh, no, no, that is a very important point, and that is a tool, again, to help us take care of people in an effective way and have a job to come back to when, you know, we need it. So, no, that is a great point that you raised. And, you know, again, I think this is, you know, part and parcel of once the initial shock of the situation is over, and again, this is where professionals can help with counseling. Once you get through that initial shock, there are a number of things you need to get in place, both with your employer as well as with your attorney. If you don't have an attorney, seeking out the counsel of a good attorney to help you. To make sure that you have everything in place so that you can be an effective caregiver.
Yes.
Because you raised the importance of your own health, you know, I will say that I did have a very good friend who pushed me to go see my doctor, and that was a great thing. You know, she really was concerned that I wasn't sleeping enough, and my doctor said she was happy to give me a prescription for sleeping pills, but
it turned out that,
you know, my doctor had lost her husband to lung cancer. Mm. And so she knew I wouldn't take the pills because it's very difficult when you're a caregiver to think about, you know, oh, I might be knocked out the person they need me. But again, to have the resource if you need it, because you want to be operating at your best when you're making these decisions for the person you're taking care of. So I really would say, yeah, go visit your own doctor, get your blood pressure, get all your blood work checked, and make sure that whatever illness your loved one is facing, you share that with your doctor, because now it's part of your own family history. You know, in my own story, I'm very upfront with telling doctors, you know, yeah, my mother has pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
My grandmother on my maternal side had multiple myeloma. Two cancers may not be directly related, but they should know there's a direct line of people in my family that seem to come up with, you know, terminal cancers, and they take, you know, the time to check me for things as well.
Right.
I think the last thing I would say on this point, and it's, you know, again, it's counterintuitive, but you have to take time for humor whenever possible.
Yeah.
You know, these are not light topics. Death and dying, terminal illness, these are not light topics, but that doesn't mean every minute of the day that you want to think about it or the person you're taking care of wants to think about it. So I shared in my book that, you know, my mom and I would watch these light but funny reality TV shows. She was very fond of Dancing with the Stars, Hell's Kitchen, anything with Chef Gordon Ramsay. We had a lot of time laughing through Hell's Kitchen and then Master Chef, which was the kinder, gentler Chef Ramsay. Whereas I would say, oh, let's watch Project Runway or a show that was on at the time called Work of Art. My mom loved for me to just climb into the hospital bed with her in the living room so we could watch these shows and just have a good laugh together. you know, watching chefs in training ruining whatever dish they were making for Chef Ramsay. And, you know, to keep some humor in the relationship was very important during a challenging time. So I would just encourage your listeners to, you know, take a moment, have a good laugh. It's good for your spirit during these difficult times.
It is so true. And my mother and I did something similar to that. She loved Red Fox. And she would, I would have put him on or have videos, and she would watch it, and she would just laugh. And before, of course, she had the brain hemorrhage. And I also, what I wanted to ask you too, Cheryl, were you with your mother when she made her transition?
I was not. My mother made a choice that she wanted to go inpatient to a hospice facility when she died. So she did ask the hospice nurse when she saw the sign that she be relocated inpatient from my house. And that was her choice. So we actually had care through the Washington Home, which I'm sure you're familiar with in D.C.
Oh, it's a beautiful facility. I understand that they are selling it now, but it is a lovely facility.
Yes, yes, they are selling, I believe, part of the facility, but they actually have both, they had nursing home, and then they also had inpatient hospice on site. And so my mother had home hospice service through them, and then in the last week, when her symptoms suggested the end was near, she went inpatient for about 5 days, and I was able to see her anytime I wanted to see her. They don't limit, you know, visits by family. So I actually saw my mother about 8 p.m. the evening before she died. I went over, spent time with her. I could tell from her demeanor that we were probably very close to the end. And in fact, at about 2 a.m. that morning, the hospice called and let me know she had passed.
Yeah, and I think, and they, I've read accounts where sometimes people really don't want us there because of their concern, how we would take it, it'll be too hard on us or something. And with my mother, I was not there for her transition, and I had been with her. She was in the hospital, and we figured I had called hospice, but my mother died the day before the hospice representative was going to get there. And I had been with Mama all night, and I was so tired when I left the hospital. But before I left the hospital, I talked with her because I knew the end was near. And I was hoping, though, that I was going to be able to get back and be there when she transitioned. But I talked to her before I left, and I told her how much I loved her. I told her that she was a wonderful mother, and that because she raised my son, and I told her, I thanked her for taking such good care of my Kevin, and I just cooed with her, and she was trying to talk to me, but I couldn't understand what she was saying. And I said, now, Mama, I'm going to get a salad. For some reason, I wanted a salad, and I went and got the salad and made the mistake of coming home eating the salad, and I said, well, I'm going to take a nap because I was just so tired, and I fell asleep. My mind and heart wanted to get up and get back to that hospital, but my body just was not participating, so I couldn't get up. I was so tired, and as you, the phone rang, and I knew what that was, and so it was this nurse saying, Miss Tab, your mother expired. So So I said, okay, and I asked her if Mama was alone, and she said no. She said that she was there, she was a nurse, and it was, a student nurse and somebody else in the room, and she said that the student nurse didn't know that Mama was dying and that she was, there was nothing else that they could do for her. So I think when Mama's breathing got difficult, this little young nurse got excited and said, well, we got to do something. We got to do something. And this nurse, she was from Trinidad, I think she said. And she said she just started singing, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. And I said, wow, see how things happen. It was not meant for me to be there because my mother, and the way it, when we finally got a room at Providence Hospital, and I have studied and talked about good deaths and bad deaths, my mother had a good death. She had a beautiful little room at Providence Hospital that overlooked the beautiful trees. It was like a park-like atmosphere, and it was beautiful. It was, they had her on the very end of the hall. It was quiet. So I thought, if I've got to go, let me be in a room like that with somebody singing, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. And that's the way my mother went out, and that gave me a lot of comfort. Of course, there are times when I think I feel guilty, and I say it, say to myself, I should have stayed. I should have, but no, I shouldn't have. I did just what I was supposed to, because I was going to come home, get a quilt, and come back and just sleep there by her bed. But it was not meant to be. And then the humorous part is, I know my mother. My mother could be a go-getter, and my mother could, as a friend of mine used to say, could tear up the pea patch when she wanted to, because Mama could be feisty. So I said, Mama probably said, now she knows I'm getting ready to leave here. She's gone. Hell, I'm going on anyway. So Mama just went on. And I think about that. I wrestle with that sometimes. But I know Mama knew that I took very good care of her. And she told my sister that I did. So I wasn't there, but I had said my goodbye before I left. But I do think that people who do get that opportunity to be with their loved ones as they are transitioning, I think that's a wonderful gift. And I remember somebody told me, I took this geriatrics class through George Washington University, and we were studying death and dying and hospice and all that. And I shared with one of the students some of the book. I think it was, I can't remember the name of that hospice. I think it's Out of My Sight or something like that. And I told her to read that. It gave the imminent signs of death, so you're not trying to force people to eat when they are at the end stage. They don't want to eat. So, and this girl said that she knew from reading that book that her father's death was imminent. And she was talking to him and saying her goodbyes, and nobody was there but just her and her dad. Her sister had gone to the store, and she was the baby, so she was the closest to her father. And she was saying, Daddy, it's okay now for you to go on. We're going to be okay. And grandma and them are over on the other side, and they are waiting for you, and they are going to help you cross over. He told her, but I want you to go with me. And she said, well, Daddy, I can't go with you now. I thought that was so funny, because he wanted her to go with him. And of course, he can't go, but we can certainly help get you right up there to the gate. And talking about hospice, that's one of my goals, Cheryl, is to work particularly with people of color to get us to accept the concept of hospice, because generally the statistics say that by the time we embrace the concept of hospice, the disease process is so far along till we don't last long. And a lot of people get into hospice and they come out of hospice because they do very well. So, but a lot of us just don't believe in it, because I think some of the myths they feel, some people feel that, well, if I'm in hospice, I'm certainly going to die. Well, we're all going to die one of these days. So if I can be in a position where I'm going to get good care, I'm going to be, my pain is going to be managed and everything, and then the higher power will determine when I'm going to leave here, but give me all the good help and care that I can get.
Well, that's a really great point, I think, to close out on is, again, this importance of professional help. You know, I mean, as particularly in the terminal illness situation, as the disease progresses, the medical profession will refer you to hospice. You reach
a
point where they know,
you
know, there aren't any more medical interventions. And
so
even though we had met independently, you know, once my mom was referred to hospice, hospice has a full team of social workers, of doctors. They can help you get everything you need in the house. And so, you know, it takes a great burden off of caregivers that especially they're not going a la carte anymore. You know, it's not my job to find a great independent social worker like you. It's not my job anymore.
That's right.
Suddenly manage six doctors. You know, there's a hospice doctor on staff. And so,
that's right.
You know, in terms of end-of-life care, it's a wonderful service. And, yes, families of all races should take advantage of hospice, particularly as most insurance cover hospice.
That's true.
So it can definitely be a help. I know we've just about gone a little over our 30 minutes, but I just wanted to thank you so much for having me on today, and I hope this has been a help to your listeners.
Oh, this has been a wonderful help, as a matter of fact,
care of their family and friends.
Oh, yes, and I'm working with a family now in a hospice situation, and I am definitely going to get a couple of your books for them and go over with them, and we are going to go over this book and share this information. And if you don't have to go right now, I was reading chapter 19 to Cheryl, and you were talking about cemetery services, and it was fun. The humor you added here, at first contact, used car salespeople and cemetery salespeople seem to have a lot in common. You got time to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, the way my book is structured, I use the first half of the book to really help people through taking care of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half of the book is looking at the estate management tasks that happen after the person dies. So in terms of the chapters you referenced, chapter 18 talks about funerals and the cost of funerals and how to save on those expenses. And then chapter 19 looks at cemetery services for those who actually don't opt for cremation,
right,
are going to purchase what I call the final piece of real estate.
Right.
Many of us will purchase in our lifetime.
Exactly.
So I'll just read a little bit from that, and
yeah,
we can close on that. So let me
Please.
Get to that chapter.
Okay.
And share a little bit of that. So cemetery services, dust to dust. At first contact, used car salespeople and cemetery salespeople seem to have a lot in common. Many of them talk fast, and it's your job to keep up with their math. The information in this section will help you do just that. If the deceased did not have a funeral plot arranged, buying one could be a significant expense, and you may need to pay for the plot and graveside services up front, unlike many funeral homes that will put the funeral services on a payment plan if you need one. Call and make an appointment at the cemetery. I recommend you take someone with you to this type of appointment. I took my Aunt Regina and best friend Liz with me. Just like working with a funeral home, purchasing cemetery services is both emotional and costly. By cemetery services, I am referring to the fact that you will be purchasing land, also called the plot, for burial and interment. digging the grave, burying the coffin, and closing up the earth. In 2010, the year my mom died, these items cost just shy of $7,000 at the cemetery where most of my family is buried. After you selected a plot location, the cemetery salespeople may try to get you to buy a couple of common upsells. The first is a vault package. My salesperson said to me, "I know you want a vault. A vault will keep Mama dry and make sure no bugs or worms get in." I took a deep breath and said, "Mommy is dead, so I believe the old phrase, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, applies here." My best friend Liz was sitting across the table from me, and she nodded her head yes, then quickly spoke up to help me. She turned to the salesman and said, "Please tell us the cost if she purchases separately and not the vault package." Liz then pulled out a calculator from her purse. Most states require that graves be lined in concrete.
Right.
The coffin you have purchased is airtight and will be locked. So unless required by law, you will not need a vault. My mom was buried in Maryland near many of our family members. It turned out that Maryland state law required a concrete liner of the grave only, no vault.
Mm-hmm.
So the liner, the plot, and the interment services, grave opening and closing,
right,
cost several hundred dollars less than
right,
the helpful vault package the salesperson tried to sell me.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I try to get people, when I have counseled with people, to do this pre-need. I worked at a cemetery, three cemeteries, as a matter of fact, and I found the work very gratifying, but talk about a hard sell. I used to tell people, everybody wants to die, but everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. So people did not want to purchase, that make these arrangements pre-need. And I would tell them that, first of all, the worst thing that you can do is go out in a cemetery park to find a place to bury somebody you love on that day that the person has died, or a couple of days after. Your emotions are high, and a lot of times you are taken advantage of. You spend money that you would not spend if you had the chance to think about this in advance. So pre-need is certainly something that people need to do, or they need to go in there with your attitude and knowing the law, whereas these vaults, because I think people get vaults and the concrete grave liner mixed up, because you're right, the casket is airtight. And even with that, I've been told by some people who work for cemeteries, when they have had whatever reason to go in and disinter people, and they, water's running out of those caskets. So once it's down in the ground, you don't know what happens. So I say to my people, don't spend a lot of money on no casket for me, because when it's over, it just go on and see that I'm put away in something, but don't go out and pay no $7,000 or $8,000 for a casket. I think that's a big waste of money.
Well, again, it's like helping people to make these decisions, and that's why I just wanted to lay it all out there, not hold back, and just say, think about all of these things, because these are real costs and real expenses, you know, and that is equally a part of having been a caregiver, is sometimes, particularly in the case of terminal illness, to have to do some of the estate work as well on back end.
Oh, yes, Cheryl. Well, we have 13 minutes left. If you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, if you speak, I know you're in the California area, but you want to talk a little bit about how people can get in touch with you, give them your website address, your Facebook page.
Well, thanks so much for that. Yes, people
sure
can definitely find me through my website, which is www.30, and that's 30 minutes www.mindfulnessmanager.com. And I do list, when I'm doing speaking engagements on the website, there are also sample resources that people can download. As you mentioned, there are a couple of chapters to the book so that people can download those and start using them right away. And I think there's at least one link to a video interview that I did on the website as well. And, you know, let me just say again, thank you so much for this opportunity, Shirley. It was just really great to be able to talk with you about these issues, share information for your listeners, including the importance of getting professional help from great social workers like you and your colleagues.
Yes.
Wherever people may be in the United States.
Oh, definitely. And that's what I hope to be able to do with this show, Social Work Today. I want to talk about all kinds of topics that affect us, affect our lives, with a focus on the baby boomers, their parents, and caregivers. And I'm certainly hoping to connect with some sponsors and have some contests where people can send in nominations for who they thought, who they think is the best caregiver in their community. And I hope to be able to give out some really nice prizes or awards to people who so selflessly give back to their families and our parents and people who were there to take good care of us. I know some people say that they don't owe us that, and maybe they don't, but I certainly wanted to be there for my parents because they made a lot of sacrifices for me to get where I am today, and I just felt that I wouldn't have had it any other way. And I think in terms of long-distance caregiving, had I known what I know now about caregiving and the difficulties you have when you live across the country and your parents are somewhere else, that's very tough. For me, my sister was still in Arkansas, so she was able to take care of my mom and dad. And then, but she lived about 60 or 70 miles away. So it was a big strain on her as well. But, and that being said, I'm also going to start promoting my geriatric care manager work because since people certainly in my situation in Arkansas, you had to leave there because there were no other than if you wanted to teach. Of course, we have the school system there, but otherwise, it's just nothing there that's really going to allow you to make a real good living. So people had to leave, but people like me and social workers and other people who are geriatric care managers, if you're living in Canada or in California or anywhere in the world, you can hire somebody like me as a geriatric care manager who will take care of your mother or your loved one who lives in this area and work collaboratively with you to ensure that they are getting the best care. So that's a good option for people, for long-distance caregivers as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, continued success to you as you continue to launch your show, and I'm looking forward to hearing from upcoming guests and seeing how it progresses.
Oh, yes, I'm really excited. I have two guests already lined up. One woman, I think she will be on perhaps the next show. She is in a situation, she's a baby boomer. And she is having trouble getting a job. And what her question is this ageism, what she's being told is, you are overqualified. And she left a job and they hired three 20-something year olds, or 25, 30, hired three people to do the job she was doing. So she is having a very difficult time. So I said, hey, we'll bring you on social work today, and we'll start a movement around that, because baby boomers, we still have a whole lot left in us, and we have that knowledge, the institutional knowledge, and we have life lessons that we've learned, and we have something to offer. Now, I think a lot of times people like us are going to have to think entrepreneurism, but we can work as contractors. We can write. We can do what you're doing. We can blog and stuff. So we cannot, just because of age, allow anybody to put us out to pasture. And then another guest I'm having on is also, she is doing medical house call. Here in D.C., we have, Washington Hospital Center has a wonderful program, a medical house call program. So when seniors are sick and frail and they just aren't able to get out and go to see their doctors, they go into the home, which is a wonderful, wonderful concept. So, and then we have a few other doctors who are doing that too, as independent contractors, which is a wonderful concept as well. So I'm going to have that lady on, and I'm just excited about bringing a lot of information. And I guess I've been remiss. We have about 6 minutes maybe, but if anybody would like to call us in this next couple of minutes and have any questions for my guest, please feel free to call in. You can call in toll free at 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Or if you are in the California area, out around Paradise, California, you could direct this 323-744-4841. Or if you want to just dial direct from wherever you are, it's area code 323-744-4841. And we are right here to answer those questions for you. And while we wait to see if somebody would like to call in, and let me give you my email address. My website is up, but I want to get it just right before I have people visit. But if you want to email me, please, I try to promote my author on LinkedIn, and she sent it out on her social media site. So if you are listening out there tonight, if you don't have questions, if it's anybody listening other than my friend Melva here in D.C. and my sister in Arkansas and maybe my son and my granddaughter, if there's anybody else out there listening, you can email me at info@socialworktoday.us. Send me an email, info@socialworktoday.us, and let me know what you thought about the show, what other topics you would like us to have, and I'll see that we get them on. I'll find the guest for you. Okay, my engineer is telling me I have 30 seconds. Cheryl, I'm giving you a big warm hug from the D.C. area, and I thank you so much, and you keep up the good work, because I'm really proud of everything that you're doing, Cheryl.
Well, thank you so much, Shirley, and thanks for having me, and you stay warm and safe through that snow in Washington.
I shall. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.